Hey, podcast listeners. You're listening to a recording made in Los Gatos on the 13th of April, 2015. We're about to say a different date for the broadcast listeners, but anyway, thanks for downloading. This is Geek Speak for Saturday, April 18th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm geek translator Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the studio is Ben Jaffe, a teacher, web developer, traveler, and music geek. Hello, Ben.
How's it going?
Also, Brian Young, iOS programmer and computer graphics artiste.
Hey there, Bonnie.
Hey. And last but not least, Lyle Troxell, software engineer, maker, father, and photographer.
Hello, Bonnie.
And we'll be talking about photography and cameras in just a bit here on Geek Speak. But first, an update. We talked last week about reflective paint for night bike riders. Who can tell me about that again?
I'll tell you about that. Volvo Life Paint, a paint that basically reflects at night. And I think Ben's story was last week. Was it Brian's story?
It was my story.
It was Brian's story.
It was a bright story.
The paint, when you use it, and in the daytime, is completely invisible.
Nobody can tell.
Right. But when a light shines on it, it shines back. And we thought, that'd be kind of cool for things. And so did the company.
It's like bike riding.
And if you want to hear the whole story about that, the show is called StoryCorps Reflects on Discriminating During Road Trip. Discrimination During Road
Trip. That's a mouthful.
Man, these titles are fantastic. And I don't understand them, but they're great. So go up to geekspeak.org. You can read more about that. In any case, we have an update on that paint story.
We do. We have a listener in Denmark, an American in Denmark, Guy Moscoso, and he says, hey, here in Denmark, there are a lot of bicycles and laws about the lights and reflectors required for bicycles. We can and do get tickets for riding at night without lights and reflectors. The front light is required to be white. The rear end and the side lights are required to be yellow. These standard rules make it helpful to immediately know which direction the bicycle is traveling.
Which is darn convenient.
Yeah, that's good thinking. Interestingly, the Association for Bicyclists has mentioned that they don't want the bicycle paint to be used, the reflective stuff, because it would create a kind of light pollution from all the cyclists and lessen the meaning of the lights on bicycles as we know it now. He says the painted bikes would be brighter than the normal reflectors and would always be white, which is the sign that something is headed towards you.
Which is not
that
good.
It could be very alarming. He said, remember, there's a lot of bikes here in Denmark.
It's about bike density, right?
Really, it is. And that would be kind of an annoyance and possibly make people start to ignore the visual inputs that we are used to already and have set put in place.
It's bike spam is what we're talking about.
It's
you
bike
just can't
spam.
Be too, you got to be informative and clear and not confuse people.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So good point, Guy. Perhaps they will find some way to put that paint to good use yet in somehow.
Hmm.
Anyway, that's an update. Also, Brian, literally an update for your Mac.
Oh, yes. So this is really important. So I'm a smug Mac user. I've always been really proud.
I know that feeling.
I've been really proud that I didn't have to run AV software on my Mac for years. And I switched my parents over to a Mac over the last decade and a half. Uh-huh. And I've been really happy about that.
And you mean smug because a Windows person goes, oh, I got to do this. And then you're like, oh, you could get a Mac.
Yeah,
and
yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've been saying that for years and I've been getting the glare for years too. But so
I'm a humble braggart Apple user.
What?
Now that you've switched recently.
Yeah, I got to get this thing. I don't know how to use it. Oh, I don't know. Look at this thing I have, like extensible.
It's a beautiful little computer.
Ostentatious object. Yeah. Anyway.
So the basic problem with Windows, as a Mac user has always said, is that there's so many exploits for it that somebody who is not aware of all the dangers of the web could wander around on a web page and find themselves downloading malware and getting their machine completely infested.
It's a dangerous world out there.
It is.
For a Windows user. Well, for a Mac user too, apparently. But
well...
Yes.
No one is immune.
So, TrueSex, Emile, I was going to get this, Carvenhammer, discovered a Mac OS X flaw, which everybody should know. Anybody who has a Mac, you should definitely upgrade to the latest OS. And when I say upgrade, I'm not just talking about if you're using 10.9, upgrading to the latest security release. I'm talking about upgrading to Mavericks. No, Yosemite is the
Yosemite.
Is the newest OS. There was a exploit that he discovered in the operating system that they can't simply patch. They have to rework the operating system as they did in Mavericks. He actually held off announcing this exploit for quite a while they got that together. It was a mechanism that Apple used privately. It was a private API.
It's always the worst kind.
Let's
make it easier for the engineers. Let's put a back door in.
Exactly. Well, somebody now that it was discovered, anybody can easily get root privileges, which means they can take over any part of your computer as needed.
So what do you have to do if you're a Mac user right now to not be affected by this potential security flaw?
Your only choice is to upgrade to the latest OS, which is Yosemite. The latest Yosemite is what you'll need.
And that's a free update.
It is a free update. In fact,
What if you've got an old Mac that doesn't run
Yosemite? I should be more explicit. Yeah. This began in 10.7. So can you remember the name of 10.7?
Well, still, I mean, my girl's computers are running after 10.7, but cannot update to Yosemite.
Yeah, so if it was one of the older Macs that was dual...
Yeah, so basically...
That was lying.
Make sure you have a router.
I don't know. You guys have been Mac users much longer than I have.
Bonnie's like, you usually know this. but isn't it only the expert... I mean, is it only the experts that can not have this problem? Or is it...
So this advice is for everybody, Windows users and Mac alike now. It's about what you do on the internet. It's what you do on the web browser and where you go. If you're just willy-nilly opening attachments from emails, if you go to any site and like to click on ads, if you like to
type in your personal information.
It's called using the internet, I think.
Yeah, right.
It's called.
Yeah.
Do you worry about getting viruses wandering around the internet?
I don't, only because I'm careful. Right. I mean, I'm pretty careful.
You're aware of where the
pitfalls
are.
I'm afraid of everybody else having problems.
Yeah. Of course.
Even professionals.
Of course. Actually, I keep in mind that even though I am very careful, it is very possible that could happen to me as well, you know? So if you're very careful about it, that just basically means that you're not the lowest hanging fruit, right? Having an old out-of-date operating system makes you more low hanging fruit. If you open attachments, if you send wire transfers to Nigerian princes, all of that makes you low hanging fruit.
That's true.
So we all need our grandmas is what I'm hearing.
To help us out?
To be the low hanging fruit.
Oh, I see.
Oh, no.
Or
that's horrible.
Or professional offices in Maine.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Okay. So in Lincoln County.
Very embarrassing.
Yes. Four police departments in Lincoln County, sheriff's office, four different sheriff's office, use the same software vendor to actually manage their network. It's called Burgess Computer. And basically, there's a system that allows the management of data, and it's the office work. Mm-hmm. All the data is on there. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, someone from that office decided that it would be a good idea to execute a thing that was emailed to them. So they ran an attachment. They double-clicked an attachment in their email, and that ran an application on their computer, which slowly crawled across the entire four-county police station system and took every file and encrypted it with an unknown password.
And
encrypting the entire file.
That's it. If you want to see your files again.
That's right.
Well, this is a police station. Don't they have a way to crack encryption?
They tried a lot to deal with this. They couldn't. Encryption algorithms now are so good that if you don't have the key, you're kind of screwed. So MegaCode ransomware is what hit them. Yeah. And they ended up paying only $300 of Bitcoin money.
Of Bitcoin money.
Of Bitcoin money. $300 to get their data back. But they did have to pay the ransom. The sheriff's department had to pay the ransom.
Well, and as I understand, they also had to figure out how to get it some Bitcoin.
Yeah, they had to also buy Bitcoin. Yeah, they had to spend money to buy Bitcoin. So the Sheriff Todd Brackett says, paying a ransom, let's say it goes against the grain. We tried to find a way around it, but in the end, our IT guys and Brewgrass recommended just paying the ransom. So they did pay it. Now, the one good side is it looks like the implementation of this software didn't actually copy data over to some remote location. It just encrypted it at the location. So people's personal data was not taken by others. It was just held in ransom.
How do you really know?
Well, because these virus
packages... They just want the money.
Yeah, these
it's
these
all about the money.
Yeah, it's about the money. And the malware packages are very specific. They have a very specific goal, and they've been backwards engineered. So there's a good understanding of how it works. And really, grabbing data, you normally can't do a lot with data compared to just encrypting. Like your photos, for example, in your home, right?
Yeah.
Your personal photos would be worth so much to you.
Right.
Pretty much, no offense, Bonnie. No one else.
Hey.
Right?
Aww.
But the point is that if I was a criminal and I want to get money from you, the best way to do is just make you not have access to them and then give them access once you give me some money.
Okay.
So seeing your photos and maybe in your photos also was your credit card statement, maybe I could like hack into your credit card company, that's actually a harder, that's not low-hanging fruit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Low-hanging fruit is just pulling the data away from you and making you pay for it.
Oh, that's so mean.
So wait, if Mac users can't just wander the internet and Windows users never could, and the police can't keep the
the only hope is to listen to GeekSpeak regularly and get help from us.
No, but what could the police have done? I mean, obviously they
not clicked on the email attachment. That's
yeah,
the thing.
It's been smarter about technology.
Oh,
no.
Oh, yeah. 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 You know, when the first malware hit, it was years ago, and I was working for a software company in Burbank, and somebody in the company clicked on this, and it deleted every JPEG in the entire system and every MP3. And we were doing radio station websites, and it crawled across the entire network and erased everything.
Wow.
And it was just one person made a little mistake. It's once you're inside a network, it's really hard to protect it.
Yeah.
Only you can prevent forest fires.
Don't click on attachments.
And to keep your network secure, you have to have every employee in your company, or you yourself, has to start thinking in this way, which is kind of
observe
terrifying.
Sort of like, smart behavior. Look both ways before you cross the street.
Like one great way of getting into a network is to drop a USB device with an executable on it in an elevator in a company, you know? And someone's going to find that, pick it up, be like, oh, what's this? Oh, 64 gigabytes. Never mind, it's written in CRAN, but I'll just plug this into my machine, which is inside of the network. That's bad news.
Yep, that's right.
So.
Muy, muy mal.
Muy mal.
Malware. These are the interlingual jokes.
I didn't see that one coming.
No, there's no really need to. all right, so let's talk about how on earth you could enjoy all that YouTube has to offer without seeing those annoying ads at the beginning.
YouTube. So YouTube, if you want to watch videos on YouTube, you have basically no choice but to watch an occasional ad here and there. Of course, there are little ways around it. You could install ad block and kind of circumvent some of them, or you could load everything with the embed code and all that stuff, and surely a lot of geeks do that. But generally speaking, YouTube is an ad-based service. And YouTube just confirmed some rumors that they have plans for an ad-free subscription-based service.
Yahoo!
So basically, you can decide, you know what, I'm tired of ads. I'm going to pay YouTube some amount of money.
Now they haven't disclosed. Pay you directly.
Right. Just like stop showing me stuff I don't want to see. I'll just give you some money so that way you don't have to, you know, try and convince
entertainment
me
with no ads. I wonder who thought of that.
Yeah, right. Once again, the public radio model finds another venue.
The cool thing about this is that if you're a content creator and you have a YouTube channel, you're probably making money from the ads that you're hopefully millions of people are seeing.
Ooh, yes. Complication.
But the subscription-based service will actually be it'll be the same. So right now, YouTube pays you 55% of whatever advertising revenue they get. And with the subscription model, they will do the same thing. They'll pay you 55% of whatever money they take in that you would have gotten from advertisements, but you didn't because someone with a subscription.
Sense. So that's cool. They're thinking of the dean.
It is. It is cool.
They publicly announced this, or is it just kind of
they just publicly announced it. Fantastic. Yeah.
Are there tiers? I mean, is it a flat fee?
What tiers?
Nobody's
like,
crying. So
I'm
far.
Crying.
How do we sign
Everybody's
up?
Happy.
So this is not here yet. There is actually updated terms to the YouTube Creators Studio dashboard, which will go into effect on June 15th. Which, if you want to be a content creator who can do this, you have to accept those terms and conditions. And then you have to wait for them to release the actual service.
Right.
Wasn't there something about, but what if I don't want to
be part
agree to all those conditions? Can I still put my own content up?
Oh, I imagine you can.
There was something about that. Mm. We'll have to cover it on a future show. It
does address the whole problem with the kids' YouTube experience. YouTube recently released a kids-only app, and the content is theoretically safer for children, except for all the ads. And the trouble with the service and the parenting outreach program came about. People came out and said, look, you're basically not following just the general television rules about how to advertise to kids. Mm. And there are strict rules, even though you wouldn't think that with sugar commercials the way they are. There are actually quite a bit of rules on what you can and cannot say. And the way that the commercials have occurred on YouTube sometimes kind of skirt that border pretty badly.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Barbie sitting down and going, wow, this Big Mac is delicious. You should have some too, kids, you know, like kind of telling them directly to go to McDonald's and buy Barbie toys and the whole deal.
So they had
examples, by the way.
Yeah, so they had ads that were specific to kids, and yet they were still skirting the rules.
No, that's the thing is there's not much rules on YouTube content, on streaming content about advertising to children, unlike terrestrial television and cable television, which is pretty regulated on what you can promote directly to television, to children through television.
Yeah.
So perhaps having a subscription model will also circumvent that.
That was my thought in the whole mind. Like, oh, well, there you go. You just say, hey, parents, if you don't want your kids to be marketed to, you should pay us.
Right. Now, the two things that I have not said are when this is rolling out and what the pricing will be. And that's because I have no idea.
No idea. And no one does yet.
So okay. It'll be after June 15th. It might be a staged rollout. It might be quite a while after. We're not really sure. And we also don't know what the pricing is. But similar services have been priced somewhere around the $8 to $10 range. Mm. So I would expect it to be something like that. But
I think I'm going to like this year. You got that going on. You've got HBO going, cutting the cord with cable.
Yeah.
TV's changing. Mm. Internet TV's changing.
Mm-hmm. As we speak. And so is photography. We're going to talk about that when we come back. This is Geek Speak here on KUSP. Fans of this program, consider also checking out the 7th Avenue Project, which airs Sundays at noon at 88.9 or as a podcast from the talk section of KUSP.org. Every week, Robert talks with a bright mind in the arts or sciences, and we all get to listen in. That's the 7th Avenue Project, Thinking Persons Radio, with Robert Pauly, and you can hear it Sundays at noon on KUSP. You can also check out his website, 7thAvenueProject.com, and that's the number 7th Avenue Project.com. Right now you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me is Lyle Troxell, Ben Jaffe, and Brian Young. And let's talk about the history of camera sales, Brian.
Okay, so we're just talking about television, internet television. It's right. changing. It's,
right, yeah, right.
There's going to be some big changes, seems like they're coming up. Well, we all know that photography has changed. Digital photography came in the last 20 years and has dramatically changed things. And there's a website called Petapixel that published a little chart about the number of cameras produced over the last century and how many per year were made and things like that. And it was interesting. And you can see that the number of cameras made in recent years has dropped mm-hmm. because of, obviously, everyone's starting to carry them around on their smartphones.
I also answer my calls with my camera. Yeah.
Well,
or on my face.
Exactly. So a photographer named Sven Skatsvix.
Nicely.
And almost.
Blew it.
He said, wait a second, we should put camera phones in on this. So he made the chart. And this blows my mind. This is something you're going to have to take a look on our website later. And
I'm going to peek at it right now.
Yeah, I'll look at it right now.
To describe this as a hockey stick, it doesn't even explain it because the stick just keeps going up. So currently in the most recent year that he has on record there, which is 2013, if you include mobile phones, are over a billion cameras made in that 1 year.
In 1 year?
In 1 year. That completely eclipses any of the digital cameras that were made in the previous years.
So let's say 1991 is a good period of time.
Mm-hmm.
About 17,000 cameras sold. In that 1 year.
Sold in that 1 year.
17,000.
14 years ago.
14 years ago, 17,000 cameras sold in 1 year. And now?
Over a billion and, reaching a billion and a third almost.
That is insane.
Wow. The chart is great, too. It's like all through history of cameras and then bam.
So we know photography's all around us, but this is just amazing. There's also a chart showing film use in the last 100 years as well. And of course, the actual use of film is going down. But what I found was interesting is right now there is about as much photos taken on film as there was back in the early 60s.
Oh, interesting.
Huh. Yeah, because the digital has I mean, really film is for sort of artistes and kind of like indie kind of analog fanciers.
I was at a party last night and someone pulled out his F4, which is a great Nikon film camera. Like the best Nikon film camera in some ways. Just this great little body and everything. Yeah. Anyway, and he's taking shots and it was so cool to be on film. I was like, mm-hmm. oh. And I do mean still pictures, you know.
But. Yeah. But I mean, to underscore how used to the digital camera world that we've become, my friend he goes by Espresso Buzz, takes photographs all the time, and he was with his nieces and nephews, and he was taking pictures, and they would look at the back of the phone. At the back of the camera to see what the picture looked like, and there was no screen there to look at the camera, the photograph that had just happened.
You're messing with us.
Yeah.
You're holding a brick in your hands.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
What is this? Where's the picture?
Yeah, but it made a great sound that could not be reproduced.
Oh, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even digitally, it couldn't be reproduced. All right. So that's the history of camera sales. Ben, let's talk about...
the history of mathematics.
Okay, yeah.
So Alan Turing, a lot of people would call him the English mathematician considered to be the father of modern computer science. He wrote a 56-page notebook manuscript when he was working in 1942 in Bletchley Park in England trying to break the German code. And that just sold at an auction on Monday, a couple days ago, for just over $1 million.
Oh, my gosh.
Gee.
People have too much money.
It's $1 million for 56 pages.
You can't get a copy of this? Yes, right. You can get tons of copies.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The actual one.
The actual thing, sure. Yes. Which is, it's kind of cool reviewing something like this because you can kind of infer how a person like this tackles problems, you know? Like, he's trying to break some cryptography codes, and how do you go about a problem like that?
Yeah.
You can see how he did it.
So, Bonnie, I think it's time for the next segment.
I do think it's time for the next segment. Let's talk about something else that did almost a million.
Oh good. Whoa. Oh,
hey,
even better.
What?
Turing was just over a million.
Oh,
just to be
this
clear.
This is just under a million.
Okay, just under a million.
So what's just under a million?
The rough numbers, So, Lyle, did you order your watch?
I did not order my Apple Watch. I was on the precipice. I got all in the cart and everything, and then I got the delivery time of mid-June for the watch. I was like, well,
and it's mid-April right now.
I'm not going to buy something and have to wait for that long. I'll wait till other people buy it, and then I'll be upset that I didn't buy it right away. And then
that's how I prefer my mental anguish.
Yes, right. I like regret much more than anticipation.
Anyway,
the Apple Watch, of course, what we're talking about, right?
Yes, and they sold almost a million units.
Almost a million units. Yeah.
Well, and Apple doesn't release these numbers, so this is divined through credit card e-receipts and things like that.
And what's interesting about this number is basically because they were only able to get this data from credit card clearing houses on purchases of money through Apple. They don't actually even necessarily know that it's Apple Watches. But from looking at trends, they know from that day that it's amount of money.
Trends, the price points.
Yeah, so basically they're able to infer this by a mass amount of people purchasing a certain amount of money. And the average price, it looks like, on the watch is $500, which is actually a little bit above the bottom line price, a little below the mid-level price. So most likely people are mostly getting the cheaper watches of the million that have been purchased. And it's actually $964,000.
Good for them. I'd feel weird if most people are getting the gold one.
Right.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
But you know what? I don't want the Apple Watch. The Apple Watch showed up as a thing I'm supposed to pay attention to on my iPhone, and I cannot get it off of there, and that annoys me.
Oh, you mean the app, the Apple Watch app on your phone?
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Wait, I don't have a watch. I don't need the Apple Watch app.
I heard about this, and I don't have an iPhone, so I just ignored it. So what's... like, what are they doing?
Well, so Apple preloads a whole bunch of apps on your phone.
Okay,
your phone.
Sure.
Your
well, this wasn't preloaded.
No, but it is preloaded first, right? When you first buy it.
It's
preloaded with apps. So all these different apps are on your phone, the calendar and the phone. You can't delete these apps. They're part of the operating system. And when the most recent update of the operating system, they added another part of the operating system, which is the watch. Which Bonnie says, it's so funny earlier, you're like, I hate this ad for the Apple Watch. I was like, that's not the ad, that's the app. And you're like, yeah.
It's an ad.
It's an ad.
Like, oh, you know how you've got the app, but you don't have the watch? Gee.
Oh, wait.
I'm like, I don't care. Yeah, so, I don't need the app. I'm not going to get the watch.
Did you even open it?
No, because I don't have the...
I don't have the care.
Care.
So the thing I did like about having that app, not that it's going to be a long time before I have one, that I was able to put it in the same folder as my Google Glass app. And so now I've got my two wearables in a folder.
Aww. Feels
so cute. They're lonely together.
Oh, yeah, because you know when someone's not wearing his glass.
You know what else is cute? So this is really funny.
Wait, I do want to know what else is cute. What else is cute,
that
Ryan?
That silence was not indicative of a lack of interest.
Wait, you're a maker. You like Instructables, don't you?
Yeah, sure.
So Instructables published a little guide on how to make your own Apple II watch.
What?
A 1977 styled Apple Watch that includes two little floppy disk drives. And
It's like an Apple II computer with a screen built in. It's got the logo, which is awesome.
Wait,
like hamsters? I don't get it.
No,
I'm not in the loop. What's,
you might have
what's
to go to geekspeak.org to see this.
Is
image.
This like a Apple II looking thing? In
is
the
that a little wind up knob?
Yeah. It includes BASIC. Come on, what else do you need on your watch?
Does this thing actually run?
Yeah.
What?
It runs.
Full instructions on Instructables.
Wait, how big are those disk drives?
They're very small. The disks don't. The disks are decorative.
You have to put them in with tweezers.
Yeah. Or they're SD cards. They might be SD cards. Check that out. Wait. The other story, which you mentioned earlier, is that the way that most people bought this watch is kind of interesting. Of the million people that bought it, a high percentage maybe didn't plan to do so.
Well, it's kind of unclear how many millions of people have gone through the Apple Store.
They just clicked on the app, and then all of a sudden...
You bought one too, Bonnie.
No!
Have you checked your credit card receipts?
Excuse me, I need to go look at something.
No. Apparently, because there's so much interest in this, people are asking around to Apple Store employees, and through a survey of admittedly a small amount, but more than 20 or 30 Apple Store employees, the average they're coming up with is about 85 to 90% of the people that try this watch on are buying it. They're buying the pre-order.
Right. So Apple set up their stores to allow people to come in, put it on their wrist, not with it live, but like just the model, and see what it looks like and feel it and talk to them. And you get like a 15-minute discussion, personalized relationship with somebody selling a watch. Very personal experience.
Mm-hmm. And I am announcing now an intervention on Lyle that he may not go anywhere within 10 miles of an Apple Store, because we have proof what will happen.
What you're saying is that if you try it on, you're 80% likely of buying it.
Yeah.
Except for you. You're definitely in the 99.
Yeah, you're skewing the... The whole thing.
It's got a computer and it fits on my body.
So fair warning, if you're a curious person and want to see what the buzz is about, don't try on the watch unless you have decided ahead of time that it's what you want to get, because you will get it anyway.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if you're going to try on an Apple Watch, go try on a Google Watch. Go try on nothing as well and see how you're liking it.
You wear a Pebble, right, which is a non-Google, non-Apple watch.
I only wear a Pebble because it has LeVar Burton's signature on the back, because I
awesome.
Gave money to the Reading Rainbow Kickstarter. I love Reading Rainbow.
And blind navigators are awesome.
Oh, there's yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I've been flying object free on my wrists for years.
Me too. Since the iPhone came out, I stopped wearing a watch.
Since college, I stopped wearing a watch. Everyone else always had some kind of a timepiece. I don't need one.
So you don't use an Apple iPhone at all, right?
Ben, no.
You've got an Android thing in your pocket, totally against Apple, in every way except your laptop.
No. I'm only against Apple's mobile department.
So why is it that...
And by against, I just mean I don't support them with my money. That's really what
okay.
I mean.
So I bring this up because earlier today, Bonnie, you asked me, why... When we're all texting to plan the show and get foods together and all that, we're texting each other. And we all text together, and I text you and Brian and Ben, and Ben texts back to me, and we're all chatting really well. I mean, everything seems fine, except...
Well, I had an experience today. I texted both of you, not having Brian's number yet.
Yes.
Texted both of you like, hey, we're getting ready for Geekspeak, right? And Lyle, you responded back on the group text, and Ben responded to me directly.
Ben doesn't like me.
Yeah, so
that's
Ben,
what I took this.
Ben,
except
what's going
that
on?
He
except
also
private communication.
He sent the
me.
Same text message to me privately.
Oh, he did.
Well, that's because
what the heck is going on, Ben?
That's because
that's twice
I
as
suspected.
Much work.
I suspected
collusion.
I suspected that you guys had some kind of Apple-y group chat that I wasn't
Apple
in
cult,
on.
Apple cult.
Wait, did you guys go get? Dinner?
We had dinner with Brian. He's got an apple.
Oh my god, I'm so hungry right now.
Sorry, Ben.
So what the heck's going on, right? That's the question.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's happening is all the companies that access our data, we have apps for and we interact with, they all want to own our relationships as much as possible. This is the kind of tinfoil hat response. Mm. So a long time ago, Apple came out with their phone and they had Messenger. Not Messenger. What is it called? iMessage.
At the time.
iMessage. You could actually create an account in iMessage, and if Apple could deliver that message directly to the person that you were trying to communicate with, it wouldn't go through the phone texting service,
right?
Which for a while was actually expensive. It's cost more money to text the phone, even though the phone companies there's no reason for this.
Text.
They charge you,
yeah.
And multimedia messages are kind of tricky, right? If you get a large image or a video or something, going through the text service is kind of bad. So Apple's like, no problem. We'll make iMessage, and it'll actually look like it's texting, but really you're not texting. You're using a service. Like Facebook has Messenger, like Google has Hangouts.
Okay.
Same types of things.
Got it.
Okay. But Apple's integrated it so well into your phone, you're not even aware you're doing it. And so when you send a message to Ben, Apple goes, I know who Brian is. They have an account with me, and I own his data. And I know who Lyle is because he has an account with me, and we own his data. But this Ben character,
he's
not
a wilding.
So sure. It's a wilding. And so what they do is they then, from their service, send an actual real phone text message to Ben's phone number.
saying, that's hey, why. Drop by the Apple store and, you know, try on some devices.
So Ben gets a text message. So when Ben sends a note back to us, he just gets the from addresses that would be valid for him, which are our phone numbers. And so he texts back to our phone numbers. And our phone number, it's a different communication because you and I actually communicating through iMessage, which
through
is
Apple
really phone number based.
And all that stuff.
Right. And therefore, he's coming from the outside. And so Apple's actually ruining our friendships with Ben.
Well, so now I understand, because last week Ben said, we need to come up with a way to all communicate together before the show. And I thought, well, we're doing it with these green texts.
We got a phone here. What's going on, buddy?
Everything's fine, except for people are losing their friendships.
Yeah, I think maybe Ben needs an iPhone. Is that no?
No.
So the funny thing is, there's never been a time that's easier to communicate with a group of people than right now. In fact, it's harder right now than it ever will be. Like, it's getting easier every day for us to communicate, right? More services, more abilities, all that stuff. And really what we have to do is come to a conclusion on what we will use. Now, for a small group of four people, no problem. Or seven people, you know, there's more geeks involved in the show. That's easy because we can just decide. But the bigger dichotomy happens when you get people that aren't technically aware at all what's happening, and it's just that it doesn't seem to mesh. And I think this complication is one of the reasons why things like Facebook Messenger or other services become really compelling. Once you're on Facebook, if you're there, everyone knows you read the message, everyone can participate, and it seems like more inclusive, even though it's less so.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I remember sitting in my dorm room in 1992 on AOL and being mad that I couldn't talk to somebody else on a different chat service, which at the time was probably CompuServe.
CompuServe, sure. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Do you know your CompuServe number? No, sorry.
I had a Delphi one or something. Oh, okay. And then I remember when the internet came to AOL, like I could email people, but we're still living with this problem because then there was Yahoo Messenger and then there was MSN Messenger. And
there's so many.
This and that and the other.
Slate is the new fun one, by the way. We could switch to Slate. Slack. That's what everybody's using. Slack. Oh, excuse me. Slack.
Yes.
Oh,
yes. What is Slate it?
Slate's a wonderful magazine. But Slack.
Slate is also a window messenger resizer mover thingy where you can write JavaScript and move your windows around. But that's irrelevant to this conversation. Slack
is a group chat system. It actually runs on top of, I'm blanking on the tech. I use it all the time. IRC. Or it can interact with IRC,
which is
Internet Relay Chat.
To be fair, that was my first
chat experience, by the way.
You geek cred pops up to the top.
The computer that my daddy made for me.
Mm. Ooh.
Yeah. Nice.
So
anyways, just to bring it back around, if you see a blue bubble, you're actually talking to somebody that's a part of the whole Apple thing.
If you see a green bubble, it's an alien outside the network who you might not trust.
Like, I want to check that.
Oh, yeah, it's fun. You can check.
Because I have seen both blue bubbles and green bubbles.
Well, that's
what about
why.
Red bubbles?
Danger bubbles. Actually, you get like a little real exclamation point. I don't think there's red bubbles.
I haven't seen a red one.
You don't get to modify stuff. In any case, you're right. Blue is Messenger or iMessage, and green is text messaging. And that might clear up some confusion for people about how the system works.
Important to point out, it's not just Apple that does this.
No.
Google has their own service as well, Hangouts, that integrates fairly seamlessly, not really, with SMS. Right?
If you have an Android phone.
If you have an Android phone, right?
Or, so I guess, a Chromebook.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a similar problem, right? So if you have a Google account and you do all your stuff through that, then you can do all of your communication, including SMS, through your computer or your other Google devices. And that's really convenient if you're talking to another Googler.
That's right. Now, all of us do have Google accounts because we use Google Docs. So therefore, probably Hangouts is the best way for us to communicate as a group because we already have the accounts and we use the Google Doc and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And in Ben's world, he won't know that he's actually in a Hangout with us. He thinks he might be texting with us.
Well, there are ways to know there, too.
That's right. They're blue or green or whatever.
Yeah. There's a little SMS logo.
Button, yeah.
So maybe I'll be joining you guys for lunch next week, or dinner next week.
Yeah, you know, if we invite you.
Did that clear it up for you, Bonnie?
It did, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, because I was confused about what was going on.
And keep in mind, this thing has been a bane of Brian and my existence for quite a while, because we have all these people in our world that we try to text with, and it's just, it's so infuriating that people don't know what's actually happening. You get confused. You have to start deleting accounts. It's a mess.
When you moved to Android, did you get bit by the whole thing where your number was hijacked?
Yes, my text messages no longer work because Apple still thought it was in their network and they wouldn't send out. It was really frustrating.
Yeah. Terrible. Well, I've got more I want to talk with you guys about in terms of, you know, what's okay and what's not okay to do with each other's devices. But we'll talk about that when we come back. This is Geek Speak on KUSP. All right, it's Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Ben Jaffe, Lyle Troxell, and Brian Young. And guys, I spent some time in the kitchen at Esalen, And among the kitchen crew there, there was this sort of joke back and forth among the kitchen crew members. If somebody left their computer out or their phone out and their Facebook was up, other people would post
them?
A status update as them and say all kinds of rude and embarrassing things. And it was just a big, hilarious joke.
Rude and embarrassing at Esalen? I thought it was like all friendly and nice and naked there.
Yeah, but you know, in any kitchen, things get a little hardcore.
Kitchen, yes,
well, it definitely
staff
got raw.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So,
what kind of rude things? Like really rude things?
I like to put parts of the anatomy in my mouth that may or may not be my actual preference.
So posting by somebody else. So,
yeah.
So something that I wouldn't be happy with my son reading, who happens to be on Facebook and connected
exactly.
to my account.
Exactly.
Not so good.
Hilarious among friends, but maybe awkward if you're trying to look like the good uncle or the good auntie to your nieces and nephews.
Maybe hilarious to friends, but not to the owner of the account as well.
Exactly. Well, although among them... You know, there was sort of like this subset of that's acceptable behavior. Mm-hmm. I understand the risk of leaving my phone around.
Are these people in their 20s?
Yeah, largely.
Yeah, of course.
But let's face it, it's the person who owns the phone's fault. Who just leaves their phone around unlocked for anybody to go play with?
People
a
who
lot
don't
of
know.
People.
Yeah. So the thing I wanted to talk about with you guys is, you know, what do you think about the etiquette of handling each other's devices? What's okay and what's not okay?
Well... So on an iOS device, it's pretty easy to have it set up to lock.
Yeah.
And therefore, things you can do with the phone when it's not locked is take a picture or call emergency services, which is always, of course, very good. And you can actually, on the newest iOS, you can set up emergency phone numbers that are always available. So like on my phone, if you find my phone and want to make a phone call to my wife, you can because she's one of my emergency contacts.
Okay.
She'll get a call. And
he's falling down and he can't get up.
Exactly, yeah. Which has happened to me before.
Ooh.
But in general... I think that's probably the gist of what you should be able to do. I personally think picking up someone else's phone and taking a selfie with it and putting it back down is hilarious. But I don't know.
Doing other things is not.
No.
So actually, I have an interesting perspective on this. So in the professional setting, it depends on where you work. For example, at Udacity, where I work, if you leave your computer unlocked, then you are fair game for someone to install a Chrome extension, which changes all of the pictures across the internet to pictures of Sean Connery or something. Because
been there.
You're right, right. Because the ideal with any company, but especially emphasized in technology companies, is you want to have everyone locking their computers because someone could just walk in, grab some computers, and leave, and they'd not only have computers, but they'd also have data, right?
And Sean Connery attraction, which way to do that?
Yeah, I've done that.
Is that abrasive environment, like, is that the best way to communicate the need for security? Like that's
to
the
talk
that,
like Sean Connery?
No. Or to fail to talk like Sean Connery, point of order.
Excuse me, the computer was unlocked.
No, the point being that that harassment does have a social impact of people wanting to protect their security. So it does work, but it also makes a pretty aggressive environment.
Yeah, that's exactly true. Like we had a lot of conversations around, is that an aggressive environment? Is that a safe environment to work? Because, you know, just people don't think about that a lot of the times. They just leave their computers unlocked because that's what they do at home. And at home, they're not at any risk for someone coming in and stealing their data.
Unless
not really.
They have a 13-year-old son. Hello. No, but...
maybe.
Now, Udacity seems like a pretty... nice environment compared to what happens at Google when you do that. What happens at Google when you do that is you lose your job. So there is that.
Oh, burr.
I see.
I don't know if that's directly, but it's very serious in security banks.
Yeah.
I would say that they get reported. You get a whole
big companies like that.
That.
Yeah. That's bad news.
Well, what about this one? Someone comes up to you and says, hey, can I use your phone? What's okay? What's not okay?
I don't let people use my phone.
First of all, is asking that question socially polite? Because it strikes me as being a little bit presumptuous and rude and grabby.
It depends on who it is. If it was you asking me to use your phone, I'd give the phone to you immediately, right? I mean, that's not even a thought.
Yeah.
Somebody that's close to me, I'm going to let them use my phone.
Yeah.
A stranger? No. An acquaintance? Probably not. I would actually say, what do you need? And maybe I'd help them out by doing it.
And that's my instinct. Yeah. Particularly when it's a young person. Hey, can I borrow your phone?
But then again, you know, I'm holding on to like a really expensive phone. Like that's the other thing is I don't want that to get broken or lost or stolen.
Okay. So let's say I don't have my phone, need to make an urgent call. I say, hey, can I use your phone? As a person asking something of someone else, what's polite for me to do and not to do? Like, what would be the best possible exchange?
What's the scenario? You like, a car's broken down. You need someone to help you out. You need somebody to call your hubby or your friend or whatever to get you help you out.
Yeah.
I think you relay the information and ask them to do it for you.
Okay. Yeah.
That's what I'd prefer. I'd say, hey, look.
Would you do me a favor?
You could also explicitly say, if you feel comfortable,
yes,
blah, 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 blah. Here's my request.
Don't put them in the pressure. But I think offering them a way to do it without them feeling like they're potentially losing their phone, because a stranger can, of course, take something from you, too. I think that's the way to go.
It seems like, well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, this is just in the last 7 or 8 years, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Because when we all had flip phones, that nobody cared, did they?
Right, you wanted it stolen so you could go buy an iPhone.
Or an Android.
But I'm not so sensitive to this, and I've tried to share my phone number. And Bonnie, you gave me your phone tonight just for me to put your number. In fact, you suggested it. But I've walked
you
up.
You should see what he pasted on Facebook. Is
funny. So I haven't really checked out the whole phone yet.
After the show on Geekspeak,
my son's really upset.
I've run into this with a lot of people where I was going to just put my number in there, and there's obviously this look of dread on their face when I actually broached the subject.
Yeah, that's a personal thing.
Well, some people keep very colorful and interesting and very private things on their phone, is my guess.
It seems like this whole conversation is an exploration of where this normally black and white picture is gray.
Yeah.
Right, like where are the boundaries not actually so clear? Where is it fuzzy? And it turns out, increasingly things are fuzzier and fuzzier in terms of privacy and security and social ramifications of small actions because of how easily data can be shared, et cetera.
You know, it's interesting. When I started doing GeekSpeak and helping people out with computers, I'd engage with them and engage their computer, and I was helping them. I was more personal with them than their computer. Their computer was this foreign thing that was confusing and hard to deal with, right? And so they came to me, and the human interaction was between the two people. Mm-hmm. And so I was helping them with this thing that was difficult. Now people's personal relationship with their computer is so intimate that the outsider is the technical support person, right? I remember at one point I picked up somebody's phone just to kind of take a look at it, and they felt invaded by me looking at their phone. But from my perspective, it was what I do all the time is understand technology and explain it to people. So That dichotomy happened in the last 14 years pretty clearly. And now I find it fascinating that the closest relationship people have to things is actually a thing, is their phone itself.
Yeah.
Of course, it does represent their ability to communicate with people, right? It is a personal thing.
It's a lifeline also.
Yeah.
Well, how about this, gang? I'm interested in hearing ideas that other people have for what the etiquette should be. Can we come up with maybe like a rule book or a guidebook for etiquette with, you know, how to use or handle the interaction between each other's devices? What's okay? What's not okay? Let's come with kind of like a rule book of style, much the same way that we had to come up with one for email so long ago.
No all caps.
No all caps.
Oh, yeah. No all caps.
You know, clear request for action in the subject line, or indicate if it's just FYI, that kind of thing. So, you know, what applies for mobile devices and interactions between each other around mobile devices?
Now, are you talking about communication between each other through mobile devices, or actually using someone else's mobile device?
Interactions that involve the physical device.
Well, I think you think about it something like, make it a metaphor of something else in your life that's kind of personal, like your hairbrush. Right? That level of, can I borrow your hairbrush?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can. Your family, right?
So there's some personal preference in there also.
I think that's got to be what it is.
I don't have a hairbrush, so I don't understand that.
I think we got to go with the wisdom of the crowds on
Please.
This one.
Yes.
So what I would love is for those of us who are interested in the conversation and would like to participate, tweet to us. We're at KUSPGeeks with the hashtag etiquette. And let's come up with some ideas together. And if we get a good bunch of them going, we can actually talk about them in a future show.
I love it. And you can also do that on Facebook if you don't participate on Twitter. And we are also KUSP Geeks on Facebook.
Okay. So let the discussion begin. And while that's happening out there in the world, let's just have a short conversation about live streaming coding sessions. Is this a little bit like, looking at Turing's manuscript to figure out how he thinks?
Good. Interesting. Kind of in a time-shifted way, or a non-time-shifted way,
non-time-shifted way, yeah.
So we all have done some amount of coding. I was working... Well, sorry. Bonnie, you should get coding, because, We asked you a long while ago.
Yeah, I hedged. I'm hedging now.
She has better things to do in her life, I think is what she said.
I really do. I've been having
Ben, are you announcing that we're going to do a live Geek Speak where we teach her to code?
Mm-mm. That's not what he's announcing.
But she won't be here.
Right.
It'll be a stuffed mannequin.
Bonnie didn't show up. All right. Well,
So what is this about live streaming coding sessions?
Right. So I've been working the last couple of days. I've been working on this particular library for encoding diffs and getting content back and yada yada. And the technical details are not very important, but I've been doing a lot of thinking. In fact, today I just kind of sat by the elevators at my work and I just stared at the wall for like 10 minutes and I just kind of let the ideas flow through my brain.
And he's paid for this, ladies and gentlemen.
And I had this...
it's the good life.
Well, when I went back to my desk, I was able to actually implement the feature I was thinking about very clearly rather than kind of fumbling around and sure. everything. So this guy, Adam Wolf, recently spent 2 weeks live streaming himself writing every line of code for this mobile app that he was working on. And there's an article, actually, that I'm going to link up on geekspeak.org about what this is like. You know, like if you are just coding on your own, so much of your monologue happens in your own head. And in fact, in my case, just earlier today, a lot of it happened by the elevator with no computer involved at all. I was just thinking all of this through, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really beneficial. So in this article, he's talking kind of about what live coding did for him during these 2 weeks.
The way he thought differently because
the way he thought differently, largely because he had to...
He felt observed.
He had to explain what he was thinking. He had to put it into words. And sometimes with coding, that can be really, really difficult.
Well, it's
a
different language, right? I mean, you're thinking in a different way of thinking. It's not English.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And additionally, languages like English can be absolutely horrible for explaining languages that have keywords that are English keywords. For example, the keyword this. Have you ever tried to explain in JavaScript
this?
What this means in various variable scopes?
Who's like, on first? What's on second? And I don't know who's on third.
It's exactly like
that. You know what that whole problem
it's
is
so
called?
Hard.
You know what that problem is called?
There's
with those
a name
words
for that?
Yeah. Geek speak. Sorry.
Right. How about that? So an interesting read, just kind of talking about what that's like. And I actually, before I read this article, I was thinking about doing this myself.
Yeah.
And
this changed your mind?
Well, I haven't done it yet.
Yeah, but you are still thinking about doing it.
Absolutely.
Because I love this idea. I mean, one of the things I did in a former job was be an evangelist, which means that I had to show people how to code and how to kind of engage in environments. And normally what that was like was spending about 20 minutes writing something I wanted to explain and about 4 hours recording something that would explain it well.
Right.
Because the truth is, as you have to have the ability to describe what this means clearly and concisely with some imagery. And the truth is, the description process of it's much more complicated than the actual doing it.
Yeah.
But he's talking about doing an entire app, which means that he had to do a ton of work.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming a lot of rework, because most of coding actually is rereading it and rewriting. That's a lot of what you do.
I don't think he did any pre-work. I think he just did it. And
oh my God.
This was live stream. Was it also recorded?
This was live stream, and I believe it was recorded.
Cool.
It was about 24 hours over several sessions, I think 7 or 8 sessions. I have one more thought on this.
Okay.
Which is that I was... So recently, actually, I released something internally at work, and everyone was like, oh my God, that's amazing, that's crazy, you're a genius and everything, because I went home.
As they do, Bonnie. They do that
as
with him all the time,
because
he is very smart.
It's because just rose petals strewn before him at all times.
Go on. Dear.
Oh,
I was hoping
now.
We wouldn't have...
Except
I was just
for
trying
us.
To like not leave a gap for all of that, what I'm saying makes sense. The perspective from the outside was, wow, Ben's a genius. He just wrote that in a couple hours. But the reality was I went home and I worked pretty late into the night building this thing because I was interested in it.
Yeah.
And then I woke up early in the morning and I continued working on it and then I released it. And then I got, wow, that's amazing. You just did this in one night. You know, it's amazing. So a friend was watching me hack together a project just yesterday and he said, you know, watching you code... humanized it a little bit.
Yeah.
Like it exposes the vulnerable part because when you code, you don't just write it. You write it the wrong way and then you back up and you write it the wrong way again and you back up.
It's the sausage of coding. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I thought that was very fascinating and it's gotten me very interested in potentially live streaming my own coding sessions.
You know, it's interesting. The stuff that I find the most feedback from has to do with the stuff that I got excited about because I was trying to figure it out. And it wasn't necessarily easy, but I spent a lot of time engineering something. At the end of it, people were like, that's cool. I'm like, yeah, the only reason it's cool is because I thought it was cool when I first found it and I kept on going. And it does feel a little bit like discovery most of the time when you're engineering. Yeah.
I wonder if that means there's going to be a live streamed coding session available on geekspeak.org someday.
You know, geekspeak.org needs a little bit of work.
We We do need a little bit of work.
That'd be kind of fun if we got together and live streamed.
All right, next time I code, if you don't join me, I'll record it anyway. I'll
live stream about geekspeak.org on geekspeak.org.
This will be incredibly brilliant or entirely
ridiculous. Yeah, right. Look, people, we got three hits. That was me testing. Oh.
Hey, do we have time for just a quick story about driving or not driving?
Yeah. Okay, so you all know that in the last 30 years, the number of 16-year-olds with driver's license has gone.
Yeah, they're not as interested. For some reason, they're not as motivated in getting their license.
That's right. According to a traffic injury prevention journal, in 2012, the percentage of people in the 16 that have gotten licensed dropped 40% over the last 30 years.
40%?
40%.
Over the last how many years?
Over the last 30 years. From 30 years ago to now, 40% decrease in 16-year-olds having driver's license.
Wow.
And that's still quite a job.
It is. And if you engage with 16-year-olds and say, you know, why aren't you getting a car? Most of the time, they're just looking at the phone. But
You did say engage with a 16-year-old.
That's true. Yeah, that's what you have to do. You have to text them. You have to ask that way. So, what's going on, of course, is that in my perspective, there's a lot of ideas of why this is happening. But one is kids are much more free to communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of transportation choices, of course. And one of those transportation choices is Uber. It is now pretty possible for teenage kids to get around anywhere they want by ride sharing with Uber. And therefore, they don't have to have the car and the driver's license, all of those things, and they can be pretty flexible. And so we're seeing kind of an uptake in that and a decrease on car sales, probably because of that partially.
Oh, gosh. Uber taking over not only all of the ads on Craigslist for jobs, but also all of the transportation needs.
And by the way,
soccer moms rejoice.
Up to 81% of Uber drivers are part-time, and a lot of them actually rent their vehicles. They don't own them. They can rent them. There's companies that do that as well.
Sounds like a scam to me in some way. All right, more about the nefarious underpinnings of Uber at a later week. This is it for this week. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So reuse our stuff any way you like. Just tell them the geeks say hi. This is public radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. Find us at geekspeak.org. And thank you so much for listening. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle, Ben, and Brian.
We need the laugh button.
Gahoff, gahoff, gahoff.
Gahoff, gahoff.
The pre-recorded laugh track.
What's the audio track for courtrooms?
What is that? Is that an actual thing?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's one scream? Who's that lady? The something or other scream?
Yeah, it's like
the
Wilhelm scream.
The Wilhelm scream.
That used to be called that was called Man Getting Eaten by Alligator 4 was the name of the original sound effect.
It dates back to the 50s.
Character.
But now it's just a goat.
Do we want to talk about this on the air?
This is the Walla. In American radio, film, television, and video games, Walla is a sound effect imitating the murmur of a crowd in the background. A group of actors brought together in a post-production stage of a film production to create this murmur is known as a Walla group. According to the story, Walla received its name during the early days of radio when it was discovered that having several people repeat the sound Walla, Walla, Walla in the background was efficient to mimic the instant chatter of a crowd. Nowadays, in response... What?
Cantaloupe and watermelon.
I thought it was beans and peas.
According
and
to one
and
story,
and beans and oats and beans. And
I thought it was boots and cats.
I think
boots
we should
cats.
Definitely.
Boots and cats.
What's boots and cats?
Boots, cats, boots, cats, boots, cats.
If someone's ever like, no, I can't beatbox. Are you sure? Say boots and cats, boots and cats, boots and cats, boots and cats.
You got to say and too.
Boots and cats, boots and cats, boots and cats, boots and cats.
Okay, we're gonna have some extras.
Is this gonna be a WebEx?
We are definitely playing this at the end of the show.
So I once saw an argument between the director of Finding Nemo. It wasn't an argument. It was something somebody just threw out in dailies. And they said, "That's so brilliant that we say mine for the seagulls," and you couldn't do that with anything else. And the director goes, "No," and he pulls out some other word like I don't know it or z and I, what, say a word,
pen,
and he's going pen 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 pen, and all the seagulls were just totally working that way.
Yeah.
Pen pen pen.
Wall is called a rhubarb in the UK, where it's
what is
rhubarb? That's what they say. Rhubarb, rhubarb. Oh, wait, that's rhubarb harder. Pie? That's like
rhubarb?
The rural.
Yeah,
juror.
Rhubarb is what they use in the UK.
Rhubarb,
rhubarb,
rhubarb, rhubarb, rhubarb, rhubarb,
rhubarb, rhubarb, rhubarb, rhubarb, rhubarb in German.
What?
They all the different languages have these sounds that sound like a crowd.
Rhubarb.
Mm-hmm.
Those are much harder to say than walla, 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 walla.